Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello, Outriders, and if you celebrated, Merry Christmas. This week we have something very special as we're going to explore the technology of Christmas past. Now, to help us travel back in time, Matt Novak, the paleofuturist, joins us. So, in our own approximation of a Christmas carol, but without a Scrooge, I think, let's see what people wanted for their tech futures in times gone by. Matt, first of all, remind us, what is it that you do as a paleofuturist?
Well, I take a look at past visions of the future, so anything from meal pills to jetpacks to flying cars, as well as the less utopian, less optimistic visions of the future, whether those are the dystopias of Blade Runner or something that's a much darker vision of what we thought would be.
This started as a hobby, I understand. When did you begin to do this?
Well, I started in early 2007 when I was taking a writing class at school, and everyone in the class had to start a blog, and I decided to just explore this topic that I'd been interested in for so long. And yeah, the interest in it allowed me to continue it as a hobby for years. And it wasn't until about a year and a half ago that Smithsonian Magazine approached me to move the blog in with them. And I've been writing Paleo Future for Smithsonian Magazine for over a year now. And I also write for BBC Future, which is bbc.com/future. And also write for a handful of other places. So, yeah, I've been incredibly lucky that I've been able to parlay this into a career.
It certainly seems like it's keeping you busy. Is it taking you to do talks or meet interesting people offline as well?
Yeah, certainly. I was able to BBC Future sponsored a show here. I live in Los Angeles, up in Hollywood. We had a show of some of my collection. One of the things that I've been doing the past 6 years now, I guess, is collecting everything I can find that has to do with past visions of the future. I've got a huge collection of magazines from the 20s and 30s. I've got tons of books and films and all sorts of anything that has to do with how we imagine the future in the 20th century or even late 19th century. I'm definitely interested in it. So I've been collecting and had a show this past April looking at various pieces of my collection, whether it's movie posters and original writings from Buckminster Fuller, all sorts of weird stuff that I've been collecting over the years. So that was kind of fun. And I should be at South by Southwest this March talking about innovation and sort of the Tesla v. Edison disputes and whether it's something we can learn from in history and sort of where does creativity come from and does it matter that people claim that Edison stole Tesla's ideas, just sort of the nature of ideas and who can take credit for what is something that's interested me for a long time. So I'm going to be talking about that down there this March.
That's extraordinary. Well, that's certainly a future that we can rely on. We know where you're going to be in 2013 at some of the time at least. But it seems certainly the Tesla-Edison issue appears to be dividing the internet after so many years. It's quite extraordinary that topic seems to have a resurgence.
It certainly has.
So given the scope of your work, we could be going back an awfully long way, as you mentioned. But for now, let's see what we can do with the 20th century and maybe have a think about what people would want when it comes to future tech, or maybe what they wouldn't want, and especially I guess things that we like around the home. And I'm guessing a lot of people, well, you know, it's Christmas, will be purchasing a new mobile phone, maybe their first smartphones for the first time, or the January sales also kind of provide you with a way to get hold of that technology at a better price. But I understand that the whole idea of this mobile telecommunication is nothing particularly new.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating to me to look at the history of the phone itself, because when it comes to sort of what we understand as radio, it wasn't necessarily envisioned as a broadcast medium. The wireless telephone was the name of radio technology, as we call it today. And much like television, radio wasn't seen as something that might be broadcast. It was seen originally as point to point. And you have essays from the early 20th century from people like William Edward Ayrton, who wrote, you know, in 1901 about his vision of being able to, I believe it was, you know, stuck in a canyon and being able to just randomly talk to whomever he liked via this magical telephone. The technology he was talking about was radio, but it hadn't evolved to the point where people could see it as something that would be a broadcast medium. They only saw it as something that would be point to point.
And around the time that essay was written, do you think he sounded like he was a bit mad? Because, I mean, we take it for granted completely now.
Yeah, I think, you know, within the scientific community, people, I think, by 1901 were fully appreciating what radio could do. But yeah, certainly people that the average person on the street would think that you were talking a little crazy if you were saying that you could talk to anyone in the world if you from, you know, the vantage point of a mountain or canyon or even your own home, for that matter, if you were trying to talk about something that was wireless in that way.
I guess it's not so different from seeing someone who's talking on a hands-free kit, because that always makes them look a bit mad, like they're talking to themselves.
Right, precisely.
And so moving forward then to around 1906, it seems like one of the problems, it is more like a luxury than a dilemma of the future, and that's the idea of too much free time. I mean, I keep putting this on my Christmas list and it doesn't seem to arrive, but why would this appear to be such a problem?
Well, you know, people weren't quite sure what to do with this free time. And it's something you see in the early 20th century, and it's something that you see in the 1950s and 60s as well. This very real concern that you would have too much free time, that automation and robots and all of the various things that were going to make our life easier would be to our detriment because we wouldn't know what to do with it. There were people that were actually very concerned in the 1960s that if this sort of futuristic, completely automated society were to evolve, that we'd have to be worried about suicide because people would be so bored. They wouldn't know what to do with themselves with so much free time. And that idea, like you said, is rather silly to us today. I mean, we can't even imagine that kind of future. But, you know, it is fascinating to look at these things from the perspective of these people who firmly believed in this sort of technological utopian vision of what our lives might look like and the potential downfall of society based upon it.
Was this related to the idea that if you weren't doing some sort of physical work, that maybe it's not good for your soul? If you're not busy, then, you know, kind of, well, idle hands and the devil's work, that kind of thing.
People do want to occupy their minds as well as their bodies and being able to make things, and I think that you hit it on the head. The idle hands is certainly was a very real concern, and like I said, I can't even begin to fathom or begin to relate to that idea. But just given how busy I am at the moment, but I'm sure that still very well could be a concern of the techno utopians today. You know, you look at people that are concerned about things like the singularity or all sorts of other techno-optimist visions of the future. You know, people believe that, you know, we are entering an age of complete robotics.
Well, I'll put it on the list for when I've got a time machine, I can go back and mess with the past. I'll reassure them that they will have things to do. But moving forward in time a little bit more again, sort of capturing Christmas on home videos. I mean, now there's more of a danger, which I'm glad I didn't live through the time when this happened, but Christmases can all be put up on YouTube on the same day. All of your embarrassing Christmas sweaters and falling asleep on the couch can all be live streamed from a mobile phone. But again, this idea of making videos at home or movies produced in the home, that goes back to at least 1925, is that right?
Yeah, you know, Cecil B. DeMille made predictions about the future of film. And, you know, he was very, very forward-thinking when it came to film. And the mid-20s was really, the 20s is fascinating for a number of reasons, but one of them is this, obviously the rise of the talkies, which was in the late 20s, but they were working on all kinds of different technologies to be able to sync sound to movies. And part of one of these predictions was Cecil B. DeMille's predictions that even within the next 20 years, people without any training would be able to shoot movies within their own home. And part of that was the rise, I believe it was in 1926, when 16mm film was released as sort of this in-between film format, at least in the United States, for you know, people who didn't know what they were doing to be able to produce movies in their own home. So I think that It was a rather forward-thinking vision by Cecil B. DeMille, though it would take a few more decades at least. You know, it was only very rich people in the 1920s that could afford to do this sort of thing. But certainly by the post-war period, you know, home movies. I transferred recently my grandfather's old 16 millimeter and 8 millimeter home movies from the 50s and 60s. I transferred those to DVD and to digital. So that was quite a labor of love, a great project to be able to you know, keep that in the family, because film obviously is a living medium that deteriorates. So it was good to get that transferred.
That's brilliant. Did you see any correlation? I mean, other than the way maybe your family looks or the things that they do, or was there much revealed from those tapes?
Oh, certainly. I look a lot like my father when when he was a boy in the 1950s. Yeah, it was just fascinating. You know, my grandmother passed away a few years ago, and it was fascinating to see her much younger and to see my aunts and various family members. It was great to have my grandfather because they were silent. I had him record a soundtrack to it. I set up a little mic so that he could talk about, you know, what was going on and talk about all the family members that I didn't recognize. And so that was part of the DVD package that I put together so that hopefully other generations of our family will get to enjoy them.
So much as you may find them an awful embarrassment if your parents record you at Christmas, they will be valuable at one stage. And so the idea of viewing with the family is quite interesting as well. A lot of people still sit down and will mark out what they want to watch on a viewing schedule. Or indeed, if you don't like what your family going to watch, you might be watching on a portable TV. Also, again, as we go all the way through this, we're going to point out that that's not new, right?
Yeah, you know, it's Tesla. You know, I had mentioned earlier, Tesla was a very forward-thinking man, and he, as early as 1926, was talking about these sorts of portable televisions, or, you know, it obviously wasn't that wasn't the name that had been accepted yet, but 1920s was very fascinating that people were seeing all of these magical things happening with radio, and it was only a matter of time that we'd be able to do these sorts of things with television, although it was well into the future. Tesla didn't get to see portable radio, if you will.
If only Tesla could see some of the things that he mentioned. The idea of playing canned music, also something that we might do while we're gathering around as a family. I mean, getting a CD or recorded music for Christmas is not entirely unknown until very recently. Maybe you're downloading music via a voucher that you might get for Christmas. But technology has been apparently killing music, as it were, for much longer than even the home taping slogan. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this rise in the 1920s of the talkies, the, you know, talking motion pictures. Before, they were obviously silent with music accompaniment. And, you know, it put a lot of musicians out of work. It's one of the, you know, we see this sort of shift from theaters with orchestras as large as 100 people. And all of a sudden you have canned music in theaters, and the American Federation of Musicians, the union that was representing all of these musicians that were playing in theaters in the United States, put out this huge campaign in newspapers throughout the United States and Canada. The Music Defense League was formed, and they spent over $500,000 running ads depicting robots that had no soul and therefore could not play music properly. It was really this defense of music that they put forward, that to defend live music in theaters was to defend music itself and art itself. And it's really fascinating to look at the ads they ran, because they used robots as this evil force. You know, they'd have something like a robot playing a mandolin, and it says the robot sings of love, but it doesn't have a soul, so how can it sing at all? So it's fascinating to see this pushback, because like you said, you know, the technology always tends to disrupt any given industry, but when it comes to music, it's kind of ironic that today the recorded music industry is the one that's under attack, as it were, and believing that they're being put out of business because people are file sharing and such.
Maybe they should look back to the robots because their adverts this time around aren't half as dramatic.
Right.
And so moving forward again into the 30s to 1939, maybe some people are looking for a tablet this Christmas. I know the Apple iPad and the iPad Mini are all quite exciting. Or if you like the Nexus, there's quite a lot to choose from now. And of course, it's something that you might use to read the news because magazines do look quite nice on tablets. But this idea of having a sort of radio newspaper receiver, that's quite extraordinary, but something that appears to have emerged around the end of the 1930s?
Yeah, it's fascinating to look at the way that people were envisioning the future of news, because obviously today a lot of written news is consumed via computer, but before people had this sort of ocean of screens within their home, they imagine that your newspaper could very well be printed over radio frequencies, that your newspaper would be delivered via radio and be printed off on a special machine that had been outfitted for just such a task. They actually did try this in the late 30s, and they were using a special band or, a radio frequency that was the FCC here in the United States allowed them to use only in the middle of the night. And it was a rather loud machine, as I've read. So I can only imagine that, it took about 2 or 3 hours to print a single page, and it was very loud. So I think that may have led to the reason it didn't get widely adopted. I don't know that you'd want a loud machine printing off a newspaper in the middle of the night.
Maybe it depends on how large your mansion is. If you can afford that machine,
right?
You put it in the East Wing or something. I don't know. On a related idea is that radio would indeed sort of transfer itself into television, as it were. I mean, we've got the sort of emergence of things like radio DNS for digital radio now, which means that pictures can be transmitted or bits of extra information that you might like to look at on a casual basis. That's starting to emerge as part of certainly the UK digital radio experiment. But again, I mean, 1940, they're already ahead of this. The future of news has been done. Maybe we should just let everybody know.
Yeah, TV had such a long progression. And as early as the 1880s, people were imagining what television would look like. And again, it was a medium that was seen much more as point to point in its early days. Much like radio, there wasn't, as tinkers and experimenters were working on it, it was much closer to what we'd call a video phone today. Television was seen as something that you would be able to just call your neighbor down the street with, or someone halfway around the world. But it wasn't until even as late as the 1940s that people were understanding that it had a lot of potential as a broadcast medium and would be useful as such.
Most of us will be sitting down to some sort of revolting act of gluttony, I presume, with our family members. This kind of made me laugh. A 1957 prediction for 2007, so we should already be in the habit of this, is that fewer corsets and more exercise. Now, that's kind of a relief, because I'm glad there are pretty much no corsets in my life. But for those who ever indulge in the festive period, I mean, was this something that would be appalling, the idea of vitamin pills and exercise instead of a girdle?
Well, it seems that we have sort of idealized this vision of the future that we do want to, become healthier through quote-unquote more natural means, although even in the 1950s, the meal pill and getting all of your sustenance through pills was just as natural as anything else. But yeah, you're totally right that there were predictions in the 1950s of being able to take a pill for your health as well as just simply exercising rather than using a girdle.
I'm pleased. Having only ever tried one on and I could not sit, I am happy. This is the future we have. That's good. But also the idea of a picnic on Mars. I mean, that's quite relevant, certainly, in 2012. We saw the Mars rover, but not quite us yet. That's a shame. We're not quite ready to have our picnic on Mars. But it was quite an ambition in 1962.
Yeah. I found this ad a while ago that looked at, it was made in 1962 by an insurance company in Michigan. And one thing that advertisers love to do is position themselves within the future. And even the most conservative kind of advertiser, which tends to be, you know, financial institutions and insurance companies, an easy way for them to be a little more radical is to position themselves in the future. And it makes a lot of sense, you know, that they, so this mutual liability company in Michigan ran this ad that claimed that you would be picnicking on Mars in the year 2012. And it would be the anniversary of this insurance company, but it would also be this part of a larger expanse into the universe that, you know, and it makes a lot of sense in 1962, you know, the very optimistic age, the year the Jetsons came out, a very optimistic time for space technology.
And of course, not that long until America landed on the moon as well. So I guess it did seem possible. One of my favourite posts on your site, and only because hindsight is 2020, isn't it? So we can all be rather smug about what people thought, because we can be right from the standing point that we're in. But this is a lovely article that's a kind of bah humbug to the internet, and author Clifford Stoll proclaiming that no online database will replace your daily newspaper, no CD-ROM can take the place of a competent teacher, and no computer network will change the way government works. Oh dear. Okay. I mean, it's good to have an alternative view. Was this widely believed in 1995?
I'd say it was much more of a mix. You know, people were skeptical that it was going to have as large of an impact as it ultimately did. But, you know, it's reasonable to be skeptical of these claims. You know, during the same time, we saw a lot of claims about virtual reality. A lot of claims about things that did turn out to be wrong. So, you know, you can understand the author of that piece, Clifford Stoll, wrote, I believe, a few years ago, sort of his response to, oh, okay, I guess I was wrong. But, you know, it makes perfect sense. I'm all for skepticism. I think that being skeptical of the techno-utopian vision of the future is perfectly fine. But at the same time, it's a little embarrassing when you get it wrong. I mean, like you said, the things that he was claiming, like that there would be no online database to replace your daily newspaper. Well, the dead tree newspaper is struggling right now for precisely that reason, that we have such a flood of information online that one definitely came true.
Luckily, one that didn't come true to quite the catastrophe you might have been expecting. I mean, a little peek behind the radio curtain is that we're having this conversation recorded for Christmas. But it also means that if this tape is playing, then we probably survived 12/12/12 and whatever the end of the world was supposed to bring. But when it comes to technology, we can be really fatalistic. And looking back to 1998, I know I had a similar book about this. We were pretty worried about the Millennium Bug.
Yeah, you know, Y2K was a very real concern. You know, some people took it a little extreme, in my opinion. I think that, you know, in 1998, there was a man named Michael S. Hyatt who wrote a book called The Millennium Bug, How to Survive the Coming Chaos. And it was, you know, it was in that hyperbolic language that you'd expect from someone who's trying to sell a lot of books. You know, he's claiming that Social Security checks will stop coming, planes all over the world will be grounded, credit card charges will be rejected, military defense systems will fail. And, you know, I think that part of it is that we did recognize that this was a problem. There would have been actual problems that we had seen if we hadn't done so much preparation for changing, you know, computer code. But at the same time, it's a little crazy to say that he was basically arguing that society would collapse and talked about the illusion of social stability and how everyone needs to get in their bunkers. And I'm just as skeptical of the doomsday prophets as I am the techno-utopians.
A lot of people, a lot of young people, if they're listening, will be considering how Santa is going to get around. And I would have thought that Santa would be well ahead on technology. I mean, if that man can get everything done in one night, then he, you know, maybe he needs to worry about leisure time. He's got like the rest of the year to worry about his mind. It seems that his flying machine went through some sort of evolution as well. He's also been affected by this sort of idea of technology.
Yeah, certainly. In the first decade of the 20th century, there were a lot of depictions of the updated Santa, if you will, and Kris Kringle was in an airship rather than a sleigh, which made a lot of sense because obviously with the Wright brothers and all the amazing aviation advances that were happening in the first decade of the 20th century, obviously the flying machine made a lot of sense for Santa.
But out of work reindeer, it seems.
Too bad for the reindeer, but Santa doesn't have to maintain all the messiness of livestock, I suppose.
If you were to pick a future from the past that you would like to envision, if that was your Christmas wish, are there things that you'd like to see in the next year, before next Christmas, that you've seen in the past predicted?
It's a great question. You know, when I was younger, it was wanting a hoverboard under the tree. But as I get older, I'm looking for more realistic incremental change and just a, cheesy as it may be, just a safer, softer world for people who are struggling. I think that, you know, living in Los Angeles, I see a lot of people struggling and would love to see a less broken structures for a lot of people.
Well, let's hope that we find a way in the next coming months. So if we want to see more past glimpses into the future and, of course, explore the rest of your work or come and see you at South by Southwest, that'll be very exciting. Where can we find you online?
I am at paleofuture.com. You can find all of the various links that I have to the various places that I write on the web. And thank you for having me.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.